Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Dr. Diego Javier Luis about his book titled The First Asians in the Americas, A Trans-Pacific History, published by Harvard University Press at the beginning of 2024. This book does a really interesting examination of Asian migration to the early Americas, mainly, but it's more complicated than just from the Philippines. And looking at the journey, both sides of this, geographically on either side of the Pacific, as well as some of the varied impacts of this and some of the implications. So, Diego, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast to tell us about your book.
Thank you for having me.
Could you start us off, please, by introducing yourself a little bit and explaining why you decided to write this book?
Yeah, absolutely. My name is Diego Javier Luis. I'm an assistant professor of Latin American history at Tufts University. And I wrote this book for many reasons. And I think like many folks setting out to write their first book, I wrote it because it's the book that I always wish I had been able to read as a student, both in undergrad and in graduate school. And the reason for that is when I started setting out to do some of the research for the book, and there was one text in particular that was a major motivating text for me to write this, which is an account from the 16th century of China by a Spaniard. Reading that exploded my categories that I had been thinking with to understand the history of colonial Latin America or the history of global empire. Thinking about the Pacific as a site within that constellation, and really the limits of empire, of ambition, and of the ability to exert some kind of sphere of influence in the Pacific, the limitations of that were enormous motivations for me. There's also a personal answer to that question, which is that my own family history is between Asia and Latin America as well. I come from a Chinese Afro-Cuban background. And even though the histories of the people that I write about in the book are not, you know, directly related to my own family history, you know, we came later in the 19th century. And the book is about mostly about the 16th and 17th and into the 18th centuries. It was hard to not feel a kind of connection to the people I was writing about. Some folks talk about this as a kind of diasporic kinship or diasporic ancestry, and kind of understanding the lives of people who, you know, long preceded that of my own family, but who are engaged with very similar kinds of questions of identity and identification across the Pacific, really motivated me to proceed with this work.
Mm. Either one of those would have been a great motivation, but to have both of them definitely helps, I think, understand kind of not just why you pursued the project, but also sort of the many different layers and nuances that ended up in the final version. So thank you for giving us that background. You mentioned a time period there, so I'd like to talk a bit more about that. What sort of time period are we talking about, and what kind of scale of migration does the book talk about?
Yeah, so the book is set during the early modern period between the late 16th and early 19th centuries. And that's because of the time frame of the main trade routes that cross the Pacific between the Philippines and Mexico, which were both claimed by Spanish Empire at this time. And so the ships that sailed that passage were called the Manila Galleons, and they ran roughly from 1565 to 1815. And it was precisely through those ships that we have this early wave of both free and enslaved Asian mobility across the Pacific to the Americas. So that's the temporal delineation of the book.
And what about the numbers of people we're talking about here?
Yes. And as far as numbers, there are many estimates as to precise numbers. The difficulty is that Spanish authorities never give us a precise number of how many people crossed the Pacific during this period. But based on estimates of how many people the ships could hold, how many enslaved people crossed the Pacific every year, how many Asian sailors were on the Pacific or on the ships crossing the Pacific, we can estimate that roughly 20,000 Asians who were both free and enslaved arrived in the Americas as a result of the Manila galleons.
All right. I think just from what you've told us so far, there's going to be a whole bunch of listeners going, whoa, wait, I had not thought of this in terms of empire, just like you did kind of coming into the project. So let's get more into kind of what's going on here and the details. Take us to Manila. What's happening in Manila socially, economically, that is making it such a place for trans-Pacific movement of Asians during this time period?
Yeah, so there's a lot of answers to this question. And this was actually one of my major motivating research questions too behind this project. Because again, there's no sort of overview Spanish colonial source that explains, oh, this is what's happening in Manila that's generating, this movement of Asians across the Pacific. And so a lot of that has to be systematically built from the ground up. But a lot of things are beginning to converge on Manila during this period. One of those is slave trading from South Asia, continuing through Southeast Asia and even into East Asia as well, that's converging on Manila. Part of the reason for that is that from 1580 to 1640, both Spain and Portugal are ruled by the same crown. And what that means is that this Portuguese sphere of imperial influence in South Asia is now more deeply connected by trade and movement to the Spanish sphere of influence located in the Philippines in Asia. And so you have an increasing slave trade across both spheres during the late 16th and into the early 17th centuries. And that means that Manila is expanding as a slave trading hub, and a portion of those captives that are arriving in Manila are being traded across the Pacific and sold at much higher prices in Mexico. So part of the answer to that question is slave trading. Another important piece of that question is that Manila was already an incredibly diverse site in the early modern world. And part of the reason for that is you have Spanish silver that's being mined in the Americas, being sent across the Pacific and sold to Chinese merchants. And there's sort of many reasons why Chinese merchants are interested in silver during this period. Namely that there's a change in the taxation system in Ming China from paper currency to silver. And so, by the turn of the 17th century, as many as 20,000 Chinese are living in Manila, far outnumbering the Spanish population. Many of them sort of fall outside of the Hispanic purview. Many of them do not convert to Catholicism, for example, and they sort of represent this existential threat for the Spaniards in the colony. And so there's the tensions between the Spanish and the Chinese populations mean that, especially after 1603, when there's a major Chinese uprising that results in the deaths of almost all of the Chinese inhabitants of the colony, it means that Spaniards are now in a greater dependency on indigenous people in the Philippines, and there are new opportunities for collaboration with Spanish authorities, either as soldiers or as sailors, what have you, in ways that further increase Trans-Pacific mobility, precisely because of those new opportunities.
That's an interesting mix of things there. So thank you for kind of giving us that glancing overview. Of course, it's worth reminding listeners that the book has loads more detail. So anyone who wants to get further into that, please do read the whole book. But I'm going to kind of continue our, I suppose, lighter touch version of it to get a picture of what's going on. Given what you've just told us, can you tell us what happens in 1603 and why this is such a key turning point in this history?
Yeah, so I had briefly mentioned 1603, but it's important to pause and consider what happened then, because it is such a major flashpoint in colonial relations of power within Manila. Because there's such a large Chinese population, it's worth wondering, is Manila really... to what extent is it a Spanish colony, or to what extent is it actually a Chinese enclave? And part of the reason why that represents such a threat to the Spaniards is, you know, they locate all these fears of, non-assimilation, of sort of eroding influence vis-a-vis indigenous Philippine populations onto the Chinese, and that leads to a wide range of discriminatory action against the Chinese in the Philippines, from sort of arbitrary confiscation of goods to the persecution of cultural practices. And this all comes to a head in 1603 for many details that there's not really time to develop right now, but that are certainly in the book. And so the Chinese population rises up against the Spaniards. And this is actually one of the most sort of violent repressions of colonized populations during the early 17th century, in which well over 10,000 Chinese are massacred as a result of this uprising. And as I had mentioned, that fundamentally changes the relationships between various multi-ethnic populations in the colony, in part because the Chinese had supplied sort of not only the economic vitality that kept the colony going by buying Spanish silver and by selling various luxury goods to the Spaniards in return, which was one of the sort of the main justifications for the existence of a colony in Manila to begin with, but they also supplied basic food products to the colony. And so people began to starve afterwards because the Chinese had been massacred. And so that creates this greater dependency on indigenous Philippine populations. It also means that Spaniards start buying captives at larger rates than before in order to sort of bolster the coerced labor market in Manila and to have people working fields, for example, so that the colony would not starve. But anyway, those relationships would be fundamental to this expansion of Trans-Pacific mobility following that into the 17th century.
I'm glad we paused on that and you went into more detail, because it is kind of quite a significant moment in this. But now that we've talked a bit about it, can you kind of take us on the next stage of the migration process? What was it actually like to be one of these migrants crossing the Pacific?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, I think it's difficult to rebuild that from the 21st century in a world in which, you know, you can fly to Asia and back to the Americas in, you know, 16 hours or 20 hours. And, you know, that seems difficult, right? But no, crossing the Pacific during the early modern period on one of these galleons was usually a 6-month endeavor without being able to stop to take on supplies. And, you know, the ship was in many ways a floating prison for the people on board. And the conditions on these ships, the Manila galleons, were extreme because the ships had to sail north, rise to a latitude comparable to northern Japan, in order to be able to cross the Pacific successfully. And that meant that the ships were exposed to harsh winter conditions, not to mention that it was impossible to carry enough food and water for the entire journey as well. And it's just, you know, reading those accounts really emphasizes just how abject those conditions, shipboard conditions were. And of course, the Asians, Asian passengers who are both free and enslaved, you know, many of them are sailors, often experience the most difficult of those conditions. Their rations are cut first, for example. They rarely have winter clothing to be able to, you know, stay warm in such a cold environment. But the other thing, too, is that the ships are trade ships, fundamentally. So the hulls are filled with these luxury goods that are being purchased in the Philippines, like silks, porcelain, lacquer. You also have South Asian textiles from the Philippines as well, that are being loaded onto the ships. And what that means is there's really not room below deck for people to stay unless you're a very wealthy passenger. So the overwhelming majority of Asians on the ships had to sleep topside, exposed to the elements, or shoved into the forecastle or aftercastle, which is, you know, even though it has some enclosure, it's still open on one side to the outside. And so that was one of the really transformative elements, that the travel itself actually creates this kind of commonality in the experience of transiting through empire, through its sheer difficulty, the high mortality rates. And, you know, after people land in Mexico, they remember who they crossed the Pacific with. They remember who else was on the ships, and that starts to forge some cross-cultural connections that are actually rather unique to the Pacific Passage in this period.
So it's actually that last point I'd like to ask you more about, because it's not just obviously the transformative experience individually, or even just the connections you mentioned across cultures. You also talk about in the book that this enacts a transition between two different forms of Spanish race thinking. Can you take us through that aspect of the transformation?
Yeah, absolutely. So so part of that is because when we look at colonial documents and see in what capacity Asian peoples are crossing the Pacific, most of the time, they're either crossing as captives or within a specific shipboard role, which is called the grumete, which is the cabin boy. It's the lowest ranking sailor. And one of the arguments that I make in the book is that grumetes could be indigenous people of the Philippines, whether they're Tagalog or they're another ethnolinguistic group like the Kapampangan. They could be from southern China. They could be from Japan. They could be from South Asia, from Southeast Asia. You have this convergence of people in this group. That's the grumete. And so the argument is that that social category begins to collapse ethnolinguistic difference within Spanish colonial language. And that flattening actually engenders similar kinds of experiences. They experience Catholicism collectively on the ships. You know, there's a very strict religious ritual that was supposed to be in place on the galleons, in which, you know, everyone would go to mass and have to recite certain prayers and so forth. And so they're beginning to experience certain elements of colonialism collectively in ways that upon arrival in Mexico, the people who are disembarking from the ship are simply perceived as a people. They're called Chinos, which literally means Chinese, but in colonial Mexico, it becomes a term that can refer to anyone who's not European and sometimes not African as well, but there's some fluidity there, who's disembarking the ship. So people who are the grumetes, who are the enslaved Asian captives, they get reduced into this chenal category. And I'm arguing that that process of flattening begins during the crossing itself and how shipboard labor is organized.
Can you tell us a bit further about the shipboard organization in terms of labor? Were there different jobs for different ethnic groups as they were considered in Manila, or how did that work if we're talking here about mixing of groups on board?
Yeah, so so this is the point that I'm making about the grumetes, that so even though you have a sort of many ethno-linguistic groups who occupy who are grumetes, they're experiencing shipboard labor in distinctly similar ways. There's only really one exception to that, which are carpenters who are from a particular area in the Philippines. But other than that, you have a wide range of people who are sort of being collapsed into this one group, having to sort of find a common language to speak together. Some of them already know each other in Manila, but many of them do not. And so this is a moment in which you have the forging of multi-ethnic connections in ways that are more intensified from being sort of restricted spatially to the confines of this ship crossing the Pacific for as many as 6 months. So that sort of helps explain some of the connections that we see emerging after arrival in Mexico, where, for example, in marriage records, you have folks who had crossed on the same ship, bringing these people to testify to the legal nature of their marriage. You have people crossing ships together who choose each other as godparents for their children. So that kind of collapsing into that shipboard role begins to indicate how some of those connections may have formed.
Thank you for kind of going into that in a bit more detail. I think it's helpful to understand kind of the impact of that, especially given how far away it is from our experience now. I'd like to ask more about the term chino, given that, as you said, it was applied kind of to anyone getting off the ships, regardless of where they actually might have been from and the different linguistic groups. Can you tell us more about the development of this term and kind of why it was that chino was the word sort of applied to any of these migrants?
Yeah. So the word chino is really an enigma. And again, this was sort of one of my major points of focus and inspiration going into this research, because it's such a strange thing on the surface. Why are all these people being called chinos? And again, there's really no Spanish source that fully explains what this term means when it first enters colonial language. So the first piece of unraveling that puzzle was trying to understand why the term chino was the one selected and that becomes codified, that can refer to any Asian. And so one of the reasons behind that, I looked into sort of colonial naming practices more broadly and found that that especially with geographies that were poorly known at the time, that often sort of a single group or place was selected to represent the whole. So one example of that would be calling the Canary Islands after the one island called Gran Canaria. Another example of this is there was one island in particular in what's now the Philippines that was called La Isla Filipina, or the Philippine Island. And then that name gets extended to the entire archipelago. A similar process happens with Asia as a whole from the perspective of Mexico. Because so many trade goods are arriving from China, and because there are sort of these best-selling texts being published at the time that talk about China in an ethnographic way, sort of it becomes the most recognizable polity in Asia. And so all of Asia gets called La China or China. And so the people who are arriving from across the Pacific from La China get called Chinos. And so that actually begins to have some important legal repercussions as well in colonial Mexico. And this is because many of the people who get called Chinos in Mexico were not called Chinos in the Philippines. They're called often called another name, which is itself another colonial category, which is the category of Indio. Indio at the time designated a vassal relationship with the crown by people who were indigenous inhabitants of lands claimed by Spain. And it indicates this fundamentally exploitative relationship with the crown, but there were also some legal protections that they were supposed to have, even if in practice they did not always enjoy said protections. But the process of going from being called Indio in the Philippines to Chino in Mexico actually removes those people from said protections. And the most important of those is from enslavement. So by being called Chino, there is no sort of legal recourse to contesting the legitimacy or legal nature of one's captivity.
Were differences in laws and legal kind of permissions and rights the only thing that kind of restricted someone called a Chino? Like, what else did it mean to be called Chino beyond just what the law said?
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of a lot of legal repercussions that are worth talking about, but there's...
Well, Ben, please talk more about the legal stuff and then we'll go beyond the law.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the other thing that it does is because people who are called Indios were considered sort of new converts or neophytes in the Catholic faith, they were not supposed to be denounced to the Inquisition. They were given sort of a specific religious dispensation from inquisitorial denunciation. Chinos did not have that dispensation. So people who were protected from the Inquisition in the Philippines were now newly vulnerable to the Inquisition after arriving in Mexico. There are also laws, particularly during the 17th century, that apply to more broadly to what we call the sistema de casta, so the caste system in colonial Mexico, and you know, Chino is one of these castes or castas. Indio is another, but you also have Afro-diasporic castas, which are the categories of negro and mulatto as well. And so there are laws that are intended to control the mobility of said populations, to control in some cases what kinds of trades they can participate in, where they can live even, and if they can carry weapons or ride horseback, trade goods in particular places. And so when Asians become Chinos after arrival, they now sort of, these laws now pertain to them as well. And so there's sort of a wide range of legal repercussions to the Chino category, but sort of more broadly than that, they become sort of identified as part of this growing multi-ethnic mass, which oftentimes is really the majority population in colonies in Mexico. And there's sort of this perennial, not dissimilar from how the Chinese were perceived in Manila, this sort of perennial fear of whether or not these people can be trusted and if they're truly assimilated, if they're true Catholics, so on and so forth. And so there's this kind of way in which Chinos become identified as part of this broader mass, which is a sort of vague threat or unknown entity in colonial society. And that's sort of fundamental to how they're racialized as a group, as an undifferentiated group specifically.
Yeah, the undifferentiated nature of it really just keeps coming up here with all sorts of consequences. All right. Can we talk about the links that are made between groups and communities, including, for example, on the ships themselves, And kind of fit that into what you've been telling us about the sort of racial organization system, I suppose, imposed by the state. What happened to these cross group connections that maybe were formed on the ships once they got to shore? What sort of communities do we see?
Yeah, that's a great question. So so this was, again, something that I was very interested in the research, which is, you know, to what extent did Chinos perhaps contest this category or embrace it in some ways and sort of form new connections with other people who are called Chinos, right? But with whom they did not necessarily share any sort of common background or language or cultural connection. So the first sort of element of that is when Asians are sort of get subsumed into the Chino category, you have a group of people called Chinos who are saying, hey, wait, hold on a second. I'm not just a Chino, right? I'm a Chino of this particular background. And one of the backgrounds that comes up the most is the Kapampangan ethnicity, which is from the Philippines, from the area just north of Manila. And this is particularly important because they're one of the groups that was sort of considered trusted in the Philippines, you know, and they serve in colonial armies, and some of them sort of become colonial elites in their own right. And so folks who were Kapampangan and crossed the Pacific, ended up in Mexico, oftentimes reference these records of service and sometimes of privilege in the Philippines and hoped to continue that in Mexico to say that, to differentiate themselves really from the Chino category. So there are exemptions made for people like some of the Kapampangan soldiers. But even those who don't petition for sort of specific exceptions to legal restrictions still find a way to reconstruct some measure of diasporic community in Mexico as well. And so, you know, I found networks of Kapampangan traders who sort of maintained friendships in Mexico, or who sort of loaned money to each other on credit. And so you can start to, with these sources, rebuild what some of these communities looked like. The other thing is you have people who did not share an ethno-linguistic background who end up selecting each other for marriage, for example, and for godparentage at higher rates simply because they're also Chinos. So even though Chinos are in general an extreme minority population within central Mexico, it's still, I think, quite noteworthy that nonetheless they are selecting each other for these close, intimate relationships and connections at higher rates, compared to other groups, even if they did not share an ethno-linguistic background. And, you know, that's happening not only in Mexico, but there's a really intriguing example of a tribute register in Lima, in Peru, beginning of the 17th century, that's also showing these kinds of multi-ethnic connections in households, or people raising money to free each other from enslavement as well, to buy each other out from captivity. And those are just a few of the sort of really remarkable examples of newly formed diasporic connections that are happening in part as a result of being sort of collectively racialized as one group.
Hmm. Yeah, no, that is, I think remarkable is a great word for it. So thank you for giving us those examples. Can I pick up though on that second example? Because it's in, as you said, Peru. To what extent was this kind of Chino collective identity happening just in Mexico versus across the entire Spanish Empire, even in Spain itself?
Yeah, so the first thing to note is that when Asians are arriving in the Americas, you know, most of them are entering through the port of Acapulco, which is along the Pacific coast, in central Mexico, but there is a dispersion outwards as well. You know, most are staying in central Mexico, but you have Asian sailors, for example, that are participating in expeditions that go up the west coast of what's now the U.S. as far north as what's now Oregon. You have a movement southward towards Central America, and you have cases of Asians showing up in the Guatemalan capital of Santiago, or at least what was the colonial capital at the time. And you have a movement that continues even further south, with this example in Lima, this tribute register, which records over 100 Asian people residing in the capital. And it's also important to note that, you know, you also have a transatlantic movement as well. You have Asians who are crossing Mexico, boarding ships in Veracruz, which is an Atlantic-facing port, and then continuing on to Spain and even Italy in some cases. So, you know, this is really a global movement. And as we start, and what I was very interested in this question about the Chino label, sort of what happens to it beyond Mexico. And what I found is that as distance from Mexico increases, you have an instability introduced in the Chino label. You have people who are more successful at contesting it. And you have a kind of slippage in category as well. And so one example of that is there's an Asian captive who runs away in what's now Honduras, and he shows up in Guatemala a couple of years later. This is in the 1650s. And he's sort of apprehended by this indigenous constable who describes him as a mulatto, or as a mixed black person. And when he sort of turns this person in to the Spanish authorities, they ask him to tell where he's from. He says that he was born into enslavement in the Philippines. And then that's the point at which the Spanish authorities say, wait, hold on a second, you're a Chino. And so for me, that's one of these really fascinating examples in which you can see the very constructed nature of these categories and how, you know, oftentimes they're really dependent on who is doing the observing and how the person is in question is also presenting themselves. And it also indicates that there is this kind of Afro-Asian connection too, in terms of categorization. And that's something that's a really defining feature of enslaved communities, particularly in central Mexico, is how racialization, even beyond the Chino category, puts Asians in frequent contact with Afro-Mexicans as well. So anyway, the point is that the Chino category becomes more unstable as we move further away from central Mexico.
Which is a really interesting finding to look at that change over geography. Can I also ask you to take us through change over time? What, if anything, changes as we move farther in time, all the way to the 18th century for these populations?
Yeah, this is one of the major questions behind the final chapter of the book, which moves forward into the 18th century and then even right up until the period of independence, the early 19th century. I was very interested in finding or seeing if there were sort of long-term continuities in Asian mobility and also leading into sort of the better known 19th century waves of Asian movement to the Americas, primarily through conscripted labor and indenture, predominantly in the Caribbean and circum-Caribbean. But one of the major things that actually changes for Asians in the Americas by the 18th century is formal emancipation from enslavement. So in 1672, there's an emancipation order that's that frees Chinos alongside a number of other indigenous groups in Mexico. And And what I found is that, you know, even though we do have this emancipation order, the enslavement of Asians does not sort of suddenly end. And this is the case with, you know, emancipation orders in the Americas more broadly, too. And even more broadly than that, just decrees that are made from Spain are very inconsistently implemented throughout the colonial period in the Americas. And oftentimes they're implemented solely to the extent in which they serve an entrenched colonial elite. So, you know, so some people are freed as a result of this emancipation order, but even decades later, even by the early 18th century, we still have some cases of Asians in captivity. But certainly by the mid 18th century, the late 18th century, the overwhelming majority of Asians in the Americas are now free. And so that that is a very important change in the kind of relationship of Asian subjects with colonial authorities. I also found that, you know, even though the Manila Galleon is the trade route really becomes seriously imperiled at various points during the 18th century. You know, Asians still remain the majority group of sailors on these ships. There's even a new trade route towards the end of the 18th century that directly connects the Philippines to Spain through the Indian Ocean and around the Cape of Good Hope. Asian sailors remain prominent on that new route as well. And are still sort of a visible subset of colonial populations, even right up until independence, you know, in the 1820s. And even when the Manila Galleon line ends as a result of, you know, Morelos, one of the famed independence leaders in Mexico, even after he burns Acapulco, and that leads to has a snowball effect that culminates in the end of the Manila Galleon line, there are still some connections from other ports, namely San Blas, which is to the north, that keep Mexico connected to the Philippines for a few years later. And for me, this sort of extension of trans-Pacific connection is super important because conscripted labor in the Caribbean is beginning precisely at the same time. And so rather than thinking of, you know, okay, the early modern period of Asian mobility is ending, and now we can talk about a quote unquote modern period beginning in the 19th century, which is something that's quite different. I'm actually arguing that the conditions, the sort of inter-imperial competition that's contributing to the end of the Manila Galleon line, is simultaneously enabling new channels of movement from Asia to the Americas that become, you know, the period of indenture, of Asian indenture in the Caribbean. So there's really more of a bleeding between the two periods of movement rather than, you know, two separate spheres.
Which is in and of itself a very helpful contribution. And that's not counting all the other parts of the book that help us understand things we didn't already. Is there anything else you want us to know or think we should know about the book as we're doing this highlights tour and coming to the end of it? Anything you want readers in particular to take away?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's a number of things that, you know, sort of beyond making, you know, these academic arguments about Asian mobility, what it looked like, you know, who it involved, how long it lasted, and sort of its nature. I really, I've returned to the personal here when I think about what I hope for readers to take away from the book, in part because, you know, I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, in the South, as a mixed kid. You know, I didn't have really an opportunity to study what I would call, you know, my own history or history of people like me. You know, and part of this is how canons are constructed, right? And what stories are silenced and left out of said canons. And you know, I never really felt a kind of affinity towards either an Asian American narrative, in part because I saw that as a very US story that didn't incorporate Latin America at the time, or a very West Coast story, for example. I also felt sort of outside of the Latino narrative as well, which I thought of as a kind of New York City and Miami story, at least in terms of Cuban diaspora. So what I'm really hoping readers take away from this book is they see elements of their own experiences in the stories of the people that I write about. I mean, in this book, I'm even though I'm talking about vast geographies and vast time periods, it's really rooted in the stories of the people who are making the crossing, their lived experiences, the decisions and choices that they made during their lives and why they made them. So I'm really hoping that that elements of those experiences resonate with the readers of the book. The other thing is, you know, the time that I was writing this is really the height of, or finishing the book rather, was during the height of the pandemic. You know, seeing the really troubling statistics of anti-Asian American and Pacific Islander hate, of course, there's a very long history of that, and it's sort of only now being more systematically recorded. But I was finishing the book in that context, and, you know, at least for me, doing this work was actually quite empowering, in the sense that, you know, knowing that Asians have been coming and going from the Americas for centuries, you know, even before the founding of Jamestown, and certainly well before the founding of this country, that I'm in, the United States. What I'm really hoping is that this work can foster really a sense of hemispheric belonging, and really shift the discourse around that. So, what I'm hoping folks take away.
Brilliant. Those are great ways, I think, to close our discussion on the book. But I do have one more question. Obviously, this has just come out, and it's been a huge project to get it to this point. But is there anything you might have your eye on next, whether or not it's a book, whether or not it's on this exact subject, that you'd like to highlight or preview for our listeners?
Yeah, a couple of things. So one, I'm actually making a podcast of my own with a couple of collaborators that's around the topic of the book, but from a different angle. It's sort of the story behind the book, and it's a very personal story. And it's very much about how one's personal experiences inform the perspective or the way that we approach historical subjects and topics. So that is in progress and will hopefully be available by May or June of this year. The second major project that I'd like to mention is the next book project. So as I was doing research for this book, one of the things that really caught my attention and surprised me, again, because it's a story that's sort of in the blind spot of multiple fields, is how both nodes of Trans-Pacific trade, both Manila in the Philippines and Acapulco in Mexico, both had very prominent, visible, and socially mobile Black populations. And in particular, for Manila, I was very surprised to learn that even by the 1630s, there were hundreds of free Black people in the city, you know, roughly half of the Spanish population. So I'm wanting to write a book that puts these sites in conversations and shows that at the same time there was, and we can speak about an early modern Black Pacific existing between these nodes of Spanish Trans-Pacific trade.
Okay, well, both of those sound like very cool projects. So thank you for those previews, things to look out for. But of course, in the meantime, listeners can read the book we've been discussing. Again, titled The First Asians in the Americas, A Trans-Pacific History, published by Harvard University Press. Diego, thank you so much for coming to speak with us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.